You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Betty Cunningham. She is the director and founder of the gallery by the same name in Chelsea in Manhattan. Betty, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to talk about your gallery and the history of the gallery, and you certainly show a lot of wonderful artists. What is the show that's happening right now?
Right now we have Gordon Moore up. He's an abstract painter who I actually showed first in 76, so I've worked with him for a long time.
And it seems a number of painters you have. Rackstraw Downs is also someone you've been working with for a long time. Is that correct?
Since 82. That's when I had a gallery in the 70s, and then I joined with Herschel and Adler, had a couple kids. And Rackstraw was at Herschel and Adler. He joined probably around the same time I did, probably 82. And same for Philip Perlstein and several others who I'd worked with at Herschel and Adler are also here.
So let's go back a little bit to the beginnings of the gallery, because it seems that there hasn't been many galleries that have done, you know, such consistent shows for so long, although I suppose there's a handful. What was it that got you involved in wanting to begin a gallery in the first place in the 70s?
I guess I've always been interested in art, and I was doing my master's in probably 19th century American at Hunter, and I switched to doing it on the attitude of collecting contemporary art upon the appointment of Henry Gelzahler. So I got involved with the contemporary field, and I switched only because I was getting a museum credit at the same time I was going to get my master's, and they wanted me to do something about a museum. And I'm not saying I wasn't interested in contemporary art. It was just that I had really gotten the bug for 19th century at the time. But then anyway, I got my master's at Hunter, which was just unbelievable because I had Ad Reinhardt as one of my teachers, and Tony Smith was my painting instructor, and I had Leo Steinberg and Bill Rubin and Eugene Goosen and Howard Davis. Davis was the Renaissance scholar
at
Columbia.
That's incredible. That's amazing.
It is incredible because I was doing it at night. I know. It just was unbelievable. And, I remember Ron Gorchoff was there teaching. And I was extremely lucky because the lucky part was that I had to do it at night because I was working. And I had been working at a law firm, and I met this lawyer who said, we have to save Olana. And that was a Frederick Church house, which, of course, I was interested in because of 19th century. So I was doing that, and all the professors at Hunter were interested in what was going on at Olana. So I'd gotten them to go up to see Olana. And Olana is Frederick Church's home. And we saved it in about 9 months. And at the end of the 9 months, the flood hit in Florence. And I was over in Florence doing the publicity for them and got to work with some amazing Renaissance scholars. But at the same time, I was still taking my master's. So I had a lot of things going on at the same time. And it kind of coalesced into going because of Olana and the flood in Florence.
Well, the flood,
where
the flood seemed absolutely devastating. I remember seeing images of that, and you know, Ghiberti's doors floating, and an incredible amount of damage. I mean, I would think that was emotionally kind of overwhelming. The pictures I saw.
It was. You know, they go through what happened with Sandy, but it really was. And I actually was taking one of the artists I represent here is Jake Berteau, and I was taking Eliza Rathbone up to see Jake, and we were talking about the fact, and she said, I can't believe you were there too, because she went over there against probably, I don't think her parents were too encouraging about it, but she went over there with other students, and there were a lot of people from Stanford and, they had kind of campuses near Florence. And, of course, there was the wonderful film, which I was responsible – I didn't create or wasn't part of, but I was responsible for moving this film, which was a 35-millimeter film with Franco directed by Franco Zeffirelli and narrated by Richard Burton, which was of the film. It was called Florence Days of Destruction. It was of the flood and what was going on, and picturing these people from various different campuses, let's say foreign campuses of American universities that were over there putting, you know, talcum powder between the pages in the Bibliothèque Nationale and you know, working on the Chimabues and all these things. So Eliza and I were laughing about how we had gone through that. But it was an amazing time, and I remember going in for my class, because I was working at the time, obviously, on CREA, Committee to Rescue Italian Art, to Howard Davis's class, who was the Renaissance scholar, in November, and saying, you know, there's been a flood in Florence. And, of course, you know, it was like killing him, I suppose. And the next thing I knew, I was on the committee. And I wasn't on the committee. I was working for the committee. And the committee was very illustrious. It had Millard Meese and, all the really big scholars. And then, this is just a quick aside, the head of the committee was, of course, Jackie Kennedy Onassis, and also Bates Lowry. And I went in to get my, something to do on my graduate program. And I told, there was an article coming out about the fact that Millard Meese had found some Sinopia, that's the drawings under the, you know, that they found in the, as they're doing the restoration. So I released it to the press. I got a call from the Times saying, it's not going up. There's a bigger story about CREA. And I said, I'm the head of publicity. There couldn't be a bigger story. And the story was that Bates Lowry would become director of the Modern. And I remember going in and saying it to Gene Goosen, who then said, Bill Rubin thinks he's going to be a director. So I was kind of caught in the center of a lot of things going on at that time.
Wow.
That was fun.
Amazing. And it's hard not to ask about Ed Reinhardt as a teacher. What was he like?
He taught Asian art. He was very modest. He taught Asian art. He was teaching at Brooklyn College, and he took, that's what most of these professors were doing that were at Hunter. They were, you know, part-time coming in. It was just an incredible group of people. Tony Smith is a regular, was a studio teacher. And to this day, I never thought I'd be forced to take painting and, you know, whatever. All I can tell you is I don't remember who was in my class, but I'm sure they're probably famous artists now. You know what I'm saying? In other words, I remember there were people taking all about tetrahedrons and all that stuff that I knew nothing about. And I just remember that Tony Smith was usually pretty happy by the time he got to our 8 o'clock at night class.
that's interesting. There was, you know, I know in the recent Ed Reinhardt show that was put together by Robert Storr, there was also a slideshow in there about images that he showed his students. And
right.
It may have been, you know, very close to what you were doing. So he was really teaching an art history course, but was it through a particular lens, I would imagine, that would lend kind of a different feeling to what it meant to be covering that history?
You mean, you're talking about Ed Reinhardt particularly? I think, let me just flip to somebody we represent, which is William Bailey. I think what happens to certain people that are interested in, and Bill Bailey talks about this, and that when he went to Asia, he saw things there that he knew meant something to him, whether it was the, you know, simplicity or the silence or the whatever it was something that he thought he could bring into what he was thinking about in his own art. And I do think that is highly influential in the kind of reductivism that you find in somebody like Reinhardt. So obviously, and I'm talking about his work, but what I am talking about also is the vehicle of his thinking that would attract him to studying Asian art and so on, studying and being attracted to it, knowing about it and collecting it and so on and so forth. So I think that's what I saw. But, you know, while I was in class, a lot of things had happened. David Smith was in the car crash, and he was a very good friend of Bill Rubin's. there were a lot of things going on that were, should we say, turning points. And I don't remember Ed Reinhardt's shows, but I don't remember, because it was an art history presentation, I don't remember talking about his work to him. I remember writing about his work in another class.
It was a time of, you know, it sounds like, I mean, with everything else going on, it was also, it still is, an extraordinary time in the art world, in history period, in the United States and in New York. What was the next step for you after that began the idea of gallery?
I was known to save all these buildings or whatever it was. I went down to the National Trust for Historic Preservation with one of the people, James Biddle, who was president, who was on the committee for both Olana and for Korea, and was his assistant at the trust, and helped put together a thing with a contemporary artist down in Washington, where we painted a wall, a fence in front of the White House. And I moved back up here because I wanted to get back to New York. And I was very clear that I wanted to go into profit, not nonprofit, not because I thought I'd make money, but because I thought I knew I had the energy to figure it out rather than had to get all these requisitions to go through. So I came up here with the idea of going into profit, and a friend of mine was leaving, not leaving, but taking a sabbatical for Marlboro. So I became a registrar at Marlboro for about a month, and they hired me, and I was only there 3 months. And Jim Harathis, who was in Washington at the Corcoran, asked me to come down and work at Reese Paley, and that's how I started out. Jim quit, and Dave Hickey came in, and Dave remains a good friend. And we worked together. And then God knows what else hit, but a lot of things hit. And everybody thinks they have some wild shows, but we had the blood show. We had so many things going on at Reese Paley. And Reese finally gave up. And that was only about a year and a half later. And I walked across the street to Mike Vannelli's and said, "What am I going to do?" He said, "You're moving upstairs." So that's what I did. And I was there until he died. And then
moving upstairs means what exactly?
I had a gallery over Finelli's from 1972 to 82.
And so you just began it. That wasn't something, you know, you understood before. And the blood show, that was Hermann Nietzsche. Is that what
that
show was?
No, Nietzsche came to that. No, it was a John Freeman show. John Freeman is the person who started the Broome Street Bar. After that, I guess he continued as an artist somewhat, but it was something that Jim Harathis wanted to do. It was, John Freeman had brought in, you know, buckets. You couldn't do this today. Buckets of blood or containers of blood from the stockyards in Chicago, and he had cathedrals of blood in Reese Paley. And of course, Reese, one of the cathedrals of blood exploded, and it went through the floors. And, and it covered, one person, his name was Jerry Hunt. He's a British painter. He covered his paintings, and it covered the paintings of Joanna Poussett Dart. And meanwhile, Jim Harathis quit. There were horrible reactions, including the health department and an editorial against us in the New York Times. And I was, you know, it was one of those things that I had gotten my master's in, and I'd never seen this before, so it had to be art. That's kind of the way we were thinking.
Of course.
Those two really suffered a loss. And oddly, Jerry Hunt did these paintings that were all white with very fine lines, kind of out of silhouette. And he was very nice. He comes upstairs. I'm alone in the gallery. We had four floors at Reese Paley. We had what turned into J. Crew and then eventually the hotel, and we had the next door space as well. And we had the two basements. He comes up from the basement. The place is covered with blood. He's crying, and I think he's like 38, so I figured he was really old. And he said he would have his representative call me about the loss of these paintings, and I go downstairs, and literally the paintings were a gutter of blood. So we pour the blood into a tin can or a tin waste paper basket. This is a really long story. Anyway, the bottom line is he goes back to London, and his representative calls me, and I pick up the phone, and it's Alana Heistein. She says, hello, this is Alana Heistein from London, and I'm da-da-da-da-da. And it, of course, it's Alana Heist, who was then married to Jean Heistein. And I guess she was going to try to get some money back for Jerry Hunt, and I don't know what finally happened with all of that. I'm sure Joanna tried to, too, from Reese Pally. Meanwhile, Reese had quit, and I just don't even ask me. It was just like chaos. Anyway,
oh my God.
I moved across the street and took over the space over Finale's.
And how did that, what was your first show there, and how did you launch that? Was it
I had about, well, Al Held called it Betty's Bowling Alley. It was very narrow, and it was just a funky little space. And I showed, in the opening show, I showed Bob Zakanich, John Walker, David Diao, Alan Cody, oh, my God, who am I forgetting? David, John, Alan, Linton Wells, and Zakanich, yeah, those five. And then I went on and I showed some other people. We showed a lot of people. We showed Ross. We gave Ross Blechner his first shows. And we had some good shows, mostly painting, primarily because maybe actually in the end that's ended up being my interest if I look back on it. But we had Michael Todd, who was a sculptor, Hillary Mays, who was a sculptor. I'm trying to think. But I think it was the nature of the space. It was narrow and painting. Oh, Ray Parker. We did a lot of shows for Ray.
Wow. And this,
anyway.
what were the years that we're talking about here? This is late 70s?
72 to 82.
So that seems a time where there was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but where there was a pivotal change in the art world. In the 70s, not only is, there's MFA programs being created, there's more museums and galleries popping up, though it's New York is still Soho, and it's a small world, and the Broome Street Bar is
and the
still
new museums started.
Right,
and Women's Lib started.
Right, all these things were happening. And then that's moving into the 80s where there's another shift, which is the market becomes something that it wasn't before. Is that correct? And if so, how did you perceive that shift in the growth of the art market, so to speak?
I would give myself way too much credit for understanding what was going on, but it's very ironic because I think of myself as a pinball machine. Like I hit the side, then I go the other direction. I hit the side, then I go the other direction. The reason I make the comment is that in about 77 or something, Vaughn, last name's Vaughn. Anyway, Jeff Vaughn did a film called The Skull Sale. And it was the film of the kind of excitement about, Skull, the taxi cab driver, and his wife, Ethel Skull, selling all their works, whether it was a portrait of Ethel Skull or it was the beer cans or whatever. But they had a whole group of works that they bought, particularly centering from Leo Castelli. And when the sale came up, what happened in the world was suddenly contemporary art was, what can I say, liquid. It was liquid money, and you could invest in it, and you could get an instant return by putting it up at auction. And that really, really changed the art world. I did this film and invited people for it, and we had this big party and everything, and it had been previewed quite a few other places, I would guess. But I knew Jeff Vaughn. He was an artist, but he wanted to do this film. And, I would like to say that I knew this was going to be the change in the art world. I didn't have any idea. I thought it would be fun to do it, because this was going to. But the truth of the matter, it was the change. It was the change. And the skull sale was the change.
Right.
And then when that happened, people became more generally informed that art was an investment and contemporary art was an investment. Everybody knew that diamonds and Rubens were investments and they could exchange them. And I remember the resentment of artists about auction and how they were terrified to go there. It was like a meat factory, like selling the bulls off the land or something, you know? And so none of them would show up for any of the auctions. And then they would sometimes try to get another artist to buy something if it ever came up, because they were, you know, it was either they get no bids or they would get one or two. And sometimes certain things would take off, and nothing like they do today. But that was the beginning of, I think, what changed this into a, you know, a money commodity, which is really depersonalized, the attention to the artist. I mean, when I say that, the individual artist kind of lost, it became less important to the art world, and the value of the art became more important.
And as the 80s move forward, you're continuing to have exhibitions. And was there a noticeable change in how they were being mounted or sold? With it, did the collectors change?
I think for me it was a change because I joined Herschel and Adler, and they were showing art, particularly representational art, which I had never shown, which is really ironic if you look at what I do today. And I had mostly been involved with abstract things, and very heavily kind of, not, they weren't Greenbergian, but certainly we were influenced by what Greenberg had stood for. And so when I went to Herschel and Adler, I remember seeing some things up on the wall, which I won't name the artist because it'll kill me. And I think, oh God, what is this all about? But it was a very, very, very good thing for me, because it really gave me, what happened is I had one child who was just born, and I had another child when I was at Herschel and Adler, and I wanted to go there with the idea that the responsibility was spread more too, also, you know, and Donald McKinney was the director, and he wanted to be director, and so I said, fine, I want to work 4 days a week. Well, that changed very quickly, but during that time, we had some amazing shows, and I was very, very lucky to be part of them. And at that time, I met Philip Perlstein, who I just adore. He's like a member of my family. And Rackstraw, who I also adore. And they're both really brilliant. And they're stimulating to talk to about art and painting. And they're generous to talk to. They like other people's work, whether it's like theirs or not. And so I got to know just a lot of people. And I realized how important it was for artists to do what they have to do rather than what is expected of them. And as a result, I decided that, like Herschel and Adler, which I never had when I was at Finelli's, it's important that each person in the gallery has his own voice, and that the gallery not reflect only your voice. And so what I try to think about is that most of the artists in the gallery have a type of energy, independence, and risk-taking. In other words, they're willing to do something that the world doesn't want of, doesn't, let's say it doesn't want of them. That's probably really a commercial, non-commercial statement, but doesn't ask them to do. They're going down their own path, and I find that just absolutely so exciting, much more so than I do the people that go down the expected road.
So you had let go of Betting Cunningham Gallery while you were, we had closed that while you were working for Herschel and Adler. Is that
correct?
What you're saying, even though you didn't mention the artist, is you were looking at a lot of representative, figurative art at Herschel and Adler.
I think I was introduced to, we did Twombly, we did Manzoni, we did Boyce. So we weren't just doing that. No, I think what Herschel and Adler forced me to think about was independent of myself, the totality of a single artist, and so therefore, if you have a Philip Perlstein, you're not necessarily a joke around here. You're not necessarily going to have 16 painters that just paint nudes. Or, you know, if you have pink paintings and you love pink paintings, it doesn't mean that everybody has to do pink paintings. It was really about if someone does the pink paintings and someone does the nudes and someone does, that they have to be the best in what they're doing and they have to be going with such ferocity after that. I like that. I like that. And so I learned that a lot. It's kind of the eclectic gallery. He used to say, which was one of his malaprops, I'm all over the fence. Well, I think with that, but what he had gotten that from or received that from was from Marlborough, where each person was selected as his own star. You don't confuse Clifford Steele with Guston. You don't confuse Guston with, Reinhardt obviously was there, or Rothko. And so they had a lot of, and they had Francis Bacon in there, and they had, you know, I probably didn't tell you when I came. Yes, I did. I worked 1 month at Marlborough, and then they hired me, and then I quit. And so I saw that. It forced me to think broadly about how individual each artist is, something that we're losing today very quickly.
Yeah, I think you're right. And to move forward with your growth and thinking and understanding, your children are growing up, you leave Herschel and Adler and then open Betty Cunningham again. Is that?
No, I left Herschel and Adler, went to Robert Miller. And I was there for about a little over 2 years. And it was two very tumultuous years for them. I went in there on 57th Street. We moved almost immediately down to Chelsea. Robert Miller had basically left the gallery but was on the phone to the gallery, so to speak, because he had been ill and was now on disability. And Betsy, his wife, was handling most of the things, and the kids were handling, were also a grown up, and they were also part of it. And there were some wonderful shows there. And I met more people there. I felt very, very lucky to be able to be part of that. And then what happened is there was a lot of pressure. And I had introduced Betsy Miller to Andrew Ong, who was an architect, or more of a designer architect. And he had done the Miller space. And I left rather suddenly from Miller. And I called Andrew and I said, Andrew, I really need to find a space. I'd love a skylight. I'd love something on the street. How much is it? And he said, well, look right behind Miller's. Honestly, this is the way I forgot both my spaces. I only looked at one. And so I got this space. And I did it with the help of some backing. So then I started this place in 2004. And we are now at the end of our lease here, so I'm as of this moment renegotiating my lease.
And so how did this feel? So there's a 10-year span. It's not at all what it was when you were, in Finelli's. It's a different world, really, for art. How did it feel to come back and open that and begin finding artists or these worlds?
It feels wonderful. I think I'm very loyal. I'm also I get stimulated by the fact that that these artists are, most of the artists here are older, so they've been doing it for a very long time, and they are. And Philip, let's take Philip Perlstein there. They're clearly defined in what they're going to do and where they're going. They're not telling you where they're going. They're still, as Philip will say, I'm so glad I still haven't learned to paint. And he will paint all day. And Rockstraw, of course, is remarkable that way. Bill Bailey's remarkable. Bill I met through Miller. And so I, you know, and there's some that I even have from before, but I also, when I said before, even from my original Betty Cunningham, some of the people at Herschel and Adler, I brought Chris Wilmarth, who I now have still, the estate, Joan Snyder, who I showed all the way through Herschel and Adler and brought here, though I don't represent her as of now. Who else did I bring from? I mean, I brought a lot of people from Herschel and Adler with me. Rackstraw and obviously, I don't know, I don't have all my list before me, but so coming back into this, it's terrific. I think it's very important that you remain yourself, though, and I think the pressures now are, I think actually the pressure is probably greater now because the big galleries are putting so much pressure on us financially, and the economic situation is putting so much pressure on us financially.
By pressure, having to sell more all the time.
I think the economic pressures make you make decisions that you wouldn't ordinarily do if you were doing it over Finelli's and paying $150 a month rent. And I really do not think you have to, I don't think that's correct. I think it's, when I say I don't think it's correct, I don't think it's healthy for the market because it becomes, well, you know, it becomes Bloomingdale's. It just becomes what's the easiest thing to sell. I had a collector in the gallery just the other day who said something to me which I really hadn't thought about. He made some comment about one of the artists we now show, Stanley Lewis, and one of the artists, and he said, you know, this will be, you know, you say it's 35,000, but tomorrow it will be 135, or the next day it'll be 150 or something. I said, well, maybe it'll be 25 million. Only saying that because of the Christopher Wool that just sold at a very high
right.
price. And he said, you know, Betty, that's not, these, we're not talking about 25 million. 25 million is goes to the artist that everybody understands. It's not to the artist that has really gone out on the limb and is going after something that it's going to, it's only, you know, it's the one that has 75 people that really want to fight over it. And maybe it's only the packaging that makes them fight over it. I don't mean how the art looks. I mean the packaging of Gagosian or packaging of whoever handles it. But it's something I think that, that is a world that I'm not only interested in, but not, I say that, but maybe the real reason is because I'm not part of it. And I certainly don't look to my marketplace and give them what they want. I mean, people that come in and say, don't you have something like flowers or something? And I think, God, that's right, I don't, you know? Although, I mean, I guess there's a flower now and then in one of Braxford's. Or in Fairfield Border or something like that. I think there is an art market, and I think there is an art world, and I think we represent Charles Garabedian, and he said in one of the DVDs or that we did of him, he said, you know, I was a victim of teaching. Now, Chaz is 90. He said, the teachers would say, this is the good part, this is the bad part, this is the good part, this is the bad part. So I get rid of the bad part, get rid of it. Finally, I got so discouraged, I started doing sculpture. Then when I got back to painting, I realized the bad part was me. And I think, and by the way, that's the beginning of Marcia Tucker's Bad Art, Charlie, the thought of that. So I think, whether it's the, I think it was called Stubborn Painting Show, and there was one called The Bad Art and all that. I think people are, it's really interesting if they look at the center of the target, they're missing the art, the artists. The center of the target is the lowest common denominator. It is the academy, and people just don't realize it. And the people on the outside are really interested. And I think these kids that come in that are in art school are I guess rightly being told how to manage their career. But maybe they should try to think about their work.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the academy and what that means, because I was talking to Lawrence Weiner a few days ago, and he was saying, you know, what people forget with all this kind of idolizing of the academy is the salon des refusés, you know, the artists mm-hmm. that don't fit in there, and how enormously important that is culturally. And I think, of course, you're right, it's so... Perhaps artists are coming out of school thinking of the market and focusing on the market, which, you know, brings us to, I think, one of the last points I'd like to discuss, which is, where does that leave artists today, and how do they kind of move into this new world that is so focused on the market, and also, you know, has a certain amount of pressure, as you're saying, they should be focusing on their work and not the market.
Right. I think there are a couple things. Years ago, we used to say never give up your day job. Of course, today it's hard enough to get jobs, but anyway, that was one thing. So that you could paint what you wanted to paint. I am finding now, you go to studios, and you have one side of the studio, which is what the artist is trying to figure out, the excitement and what they want to do. And then you have the other side, but I think this will sell. And I don't mean that my artists say that to me, but one thing that came up, I was hanging a show here, and one of the artist for whom I was hanging it said, why did you take all those pictures? I thought they were the most saleable. And I thought, I didn't even think of that. But I'm thinking now what's happening is that, and this was a younger artist who said this, what's happening is that the artist is also feeling this pressure that they have to fit in, which is a totally non-creative art point of view, but they feel that they have to, they have to pay the rent, and that makes them suddenly realize that they have to be able to make this work. And their parents say, "Oh my God, don't be an artist. If you are going to be an artist, you better do this, that, and the other thing." And I, so when a young group comes in here, of students, I tell them the story about Chaz. That maybe they're responsible for the bad. Maybe the bad part is themselves. Never be afraid of what you're going after. That would be the first thing. And never let anybody tell you you're not going after the right thing in your painting. I mean, let them tell you, but don't, you know, there's a great story about Chuck Close, who got told he wasn't doing the right thing by Al Held, Al Held started painting on one of his paintings at Yale. And Chuck Close, who obviously had the, even then, chutzpah, put a sign up, never let Al Held come back into his studio. But a lot of kids at Yale get that, and they start trying to paint like whoever was there to force them to do it that way. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with graduate school, but I do think there's something wrong with the emphasis on marketing and career, because after all, aren't you doing Sunday painters? You're doing what you really love, and you're excited about it. And you have to figure out how to pay your way in a very expensive world and still have the freedom to really selfishly do what you really want to do, what you really want. I mean, every day you go into the studio, I find it really interesting going on studio visits. If I understand it right away, it's not even worth it. And if I don't understand it, that's the more exciting visit.
Betty, thanks so much for talking with us today. You know, in closing, what you just said was very powerful, and it reminds me of what you said a little bit earlier in our talk. I believe it was around the time of Herschel and Adler, when you were talking about the notion of artists not being so much part of a group or a trend in thinking, although you didn't use those words, but that they each kind of created their own sphere of thinking, and maybe leader is the wrong word, but it seemed to me to be talking about artists as the opposite of what may be taught in often in schools and in MFA programs, which is there's a way to do things or a way to approach things, when in fact it should be the opposite, really. And your
absolutely. And beyond that, if you ever, I've often said that a movement, once a movement is named, whether it's pop art or op art or I don't know, lyrical abstraction, it's over. And the reason you can think of that, Chris Wilmarth said, who very often is put into minimal art, he said minimal art is like walking into a brick wall. And you know that Alex Katz has been put into pop art, which has totally been rethought. What you have to do, and I think it's really important, and I think it's also with the disparaging feeling about lyrical abstraction or about Greenbergian whatever, if everybody thinks that minimal art is male, macho, abstract, it couldn't exist without lyrical abstraction, because lyrical abstraction was all about the paint anyway. And I find it's just so interesting if you can separate yourself from the word isn't cliche, but the quick, organized, kind of locked-in school, so to speak, and you look at the fringes of those schools. I'm very interested in Forrest Best, because he was at Betty Parsons and such an eccentric. I don't know whether you know his – do you know his work?
I do.
Yeah. I'm very interested in a person like that, not because of his operation and all that crazy stuff, but because he was really eccentric and well-educated in Bay City, Texas, and yet he still carried on a correspondence with Meyer Shapiro. He still was at Betty Parsons hanging with Jackson Pollock and Barnett Newman. And I'm fascinated with how a person can be eccentrically whole at the same time he participates in a marketplace. And I think the answer is that there was no marketplace at Betty Parsons at that time. It was really hard to sell, and probably he could get away with it. I think that if Christopher Wool were a fly fisherman down there trying to, I think the marketplaces overwhelmed artists, overwhelmed them. And I think they know it.
I think so, too. I think that's part of the changing landscape of it. But it's refreshing to know that there are people like yourselves, as well as many others, and artists still functioning and operating in a way that isn't unlike the 70s, in the sense that though we have all these pressures, it seems that the pearl, what everyone's still reaching for on a very heartfelt level, on an aesthetic level, is this kind of unique quality, this ability to do as you're saying what Forrest was doing, to be the eccentric
be yourself. I mean, as a dealer, I hope I stay myself. No matter how big the space is or how small the space, I hope I stay myself. I will. One thing that really struck me, and this is just an empirical thing, and the way I'm a very inductive thinker. I'm not a deductive thinker. I look at everything and I pull it from that. The other day, we did a show this early season with another gallery, but we did Chuck Webster. He's an abstract painter, fabulous painter, really good. And his mentor was Stanley Lewis, who's one of our people here. And Bill Bailey came in for lunch, and Chuck was here, and Bill Bailey was head of the art school for a short period of time, but also taught there for 25 years and still lives up at Yale. And I tell you this story because it's about Yale. And Chuck was very excited to talk to Bill, because Bill had been a critique for him. And so they're talking about this, and Bill said, I remember that. Where were you? And he said, I did apply to Yale, but I didn't get in, so I went to American University. And I just looked at Chuck as he said that, and I thought to myself, how lucky you were. Because now he's himself. And, you know, sometimes the things around us are bigger than we are. Never let the gallery be bigger than you are. Never let the person next to you tell you what to do. I think it's extremely important. And so what happens is you might have had a great class with Rockstraw was there and Janet Fish and Chuck Close and all this. They've had some wonderful people later, and John Curran and some of those people. But the truth of the matter is Yale doesn't make them. They are who they are. And what is interesting is an American university has a fabulous department. In fact, Stanley Lewis was teaching there. But what's interesting is that it hasn't, as Columbia also, it never, at the point it wasn't yet formed, it is the best school. When it gets formed, you move to the next school. And as somebody said to me about starting a gallery, here I am in Chelsea, isn't the new place that everybody goes is to East Village? And I said, don't look at the place where everybody goes. Look to the place where you think somebody might go. And that's where I feel.
I like that.
Anyway, enough.
It's been wonderful talking with you. And I know the question that everyone's going to ask or think about, they hear this interview. It's wonderful. Betty sounds like, just the person that you would love to have represent your work or be working with. How do you handle artists being interested in talking to you or having studio visits? What is your policy on that, or how would you suggest anybody who may be thinking after this interview of coming to see your shows and contacting you handle that situation?
Well, at the moment, which was the worst thing in the whole wide world, when I was at Marlboro, I met a lot of people, including Dave McKee and stuff. And then when I went down to Reese Pally, and we had a lot of famous people coming in, I'd say, oh, my God, Mr. Mellon is walking in the front door, and I'd make everybody crazy up at Marlboro. When I moved across the street to Finelli's and the doorbell rang, I said, oh, my God, a murderer is coming up the store. So, you know, my whole vantage point when I started doing this. But if people ask me who my audience is, it's only artists. How do I find collectors? I find it through artists. Why am I in this business? Because I really do believe in artists, and maybe if I were lucky, I would have been an artist myself, though I don't think I would have been a good one. And so anyway, so I say that, but now what I say when somebody says, who's in the gallery, you know what the risk of answer is? Oh, it's just an artist. And I always find that very funny. But what would I say? Right now we're saying we're not looking because I am negotiating this lease, and I am being threatened with having to move. And that's a really scary thing, particularly given the finances of a downturned, now about to come back up, hopefully, market, a totally different market, and a very aggressive real estate market. So it's just a devastating thing. So that would be the first thing to tell you that I'm not looking, but I look all the time. And I try to look and see things. I usually get the main people that I go to are usually referred to me by other artists in the gallery or something like that. But right now, my time is much more stretched out on this. Unfortunately, like everybody else, it's stretched out for real estate, you know. But what would I advise? I'm going to go back to the other thing. Get a day job. Do I think it's important to live in New York? It's nice to be available because it really does make a difference if I have to go to a far-off place to see an artist. But I don't think it's essential anymore, and I'm not sure that New York is the center anymore. And I'm not sure that, I don't know where the center is in Manhattan. I think the center is in your studio. And that's why I go back to Forest Best. I think the center is in Bay City, Texas. I just figured it out. You know?
That's wonderful.
I think, remember what Chaz said, you know, I found out the bad stuff was me. And there's a very good show on now at Pavel's, which of course I'm telling you about, but I haven't seen, about Holly Solomon and her gallery. And I worked at the same time when she was open, and I used to think her gallery was very glitzy. She very much emphasized the Hollywood. She was an actress and the glitziness, and she had all these things. She showed such remarkable artists. And they came across as being, it seemed like there were diamonds on every piece of painting that she ever had, but it ended up being Joe Zucker. It was Garibedi, and it was just a lot of people, well, Gordon Maddox Clark was certainly not glitzy. But anyway, she had a fabulous gallery, and there's a show of that, what was going on in the 70s there.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I'd like to see that show. And Betty, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.